This is the Voice of America broadcasting throughout the world with live coverage of the flight of Apollo 14. Now, 135 hours and 8 minutes into the mission. Astronauts Shepard and Mitchell, now in their second EVA period. We take you to the Manned Spacecraft Center and space correspondent Rhett Turner.
Okay, we're still following the traverse of the lunar surface by Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell as they're coming back down the slope from Cone Crater past the Triplet Crater in the past few minutes. As we last reported to you, Al Shepard was taking a core tube sample near the Triplet Crater formation, which is some 300 meters, about maybe 150 meters to the east of the landing site itself. This is Ed Mitchell on the surface.
Okay, I'm really kind of through with this trench.
Roger, Al.
I think he's still working on a trenching sample. This is one of the major experiments we'll describe to you in more detail also as we go. The Triplet Crater was one of the major features over which Shepard piloted the lunar module Antares as they landed on the surface.
Shepard has apparently completed his trench digging task while Ed Mitchell continuing in his attempt to drive the triple core sample, the triple core tube.
Now they've screwed together three of these tubes, which are about 15 inches long, so hopefully he can drive it down into the surface as much as a meter, and that is a difficult task. And with us, joining us now in our broadcast, is a man who should know how difficult it is to drive a core tube into the surface of the moon, the second man on the moon, astronaut Buzz Aldrin. Buzz, you've been busy going around and following activities this morning so far, haven't you?
Yes, I've...
They caught us all by surprise.
Well, I've been most impressed with the ability that they've had in carrying out their tasks. Obviously, they've encountered a little bit more difficulty than they anticipated in working their way up the edges of Cone Crater.
That appeared to be a pretty steep slope, then, even steeper than we were able to calculate ahead of time.
Well, huh? I can't wait to see some of the pictures that they're going to bring back to that. It's really going to be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. How hard is it to get a core tube into the surface? Were you able to get a triple core all the way down?
No, nothing like that. We just worked with a single core, and even with that, we had difficulty going much more than 9 or 10 inches.
Mm-hmm. So you all of these experiments give the triple core samples there, and they do attempt to get them in. Let's see what's happening here.
And it will make the surface with a second layer.
Roger, Al.
Shepard is attempting this.
I finally end up getting down.
How far did you get down, he's asked.
You know, the trench is about a foot and a half deep. I gave up, actually, not because it was hard digging, but because the walls kept falling in on it. And it was covering all the evidence of
stratigraphy. Roger.
That's a report on the trench. Now, that's something else we want to describe in some more detail. Let's see.
Over 20 feet, 50 feet from where Al is. And on the east side of these craters,
this is Mitchell.
I have a triple core in, about a tube and a quarter, and it's tightening up again. I just don't think it's going to go the rest of the way.
How far is that, Buzz? A tube and a quarter, some 20 inches?
Yeah, I think it's about 15 inches in
per
the tube. Yeah, so he's
down
about 20 inches, and I'd say that's quite a ways down.
Mm-hmm. They mentioned as they came into this weird, the Triplet Crater area, that there was some fairly soft material. In fact, that's when Al Shepard started his trench and found it soft, and as we just heard him report, he got down a foot and a half, a little less than half a meter, and the side started caving in. They're particularly interested in the stratosphere.
Yeah, they've been getting, he's been reporting on the very various layers that he's seen, dark brown layer and crystalline layers, which is very unusual. We didn't see anything like that. Of course, we didn't have the opportunity to stop and dig that deep. And they've got a special entrenching tool that enables them to do this.
It does indeed sound as though this Palmaro Highlands area does have some more additional features than you and Neil Armstrong found in Tranquility Base.
Oh, it certainly does, yes.
In fact, I'm already getting a little excited over that white rock myself. How about you? Do you feel like you became a geologist yourself during that excursion?
Well, we attempted to learn as much as we could about it, but our area was very dull in comparison to the area that they're in.
Let's see what I see.
It's a combination of the top two layers. Second layer is a thin layer of small glassy-like pebbles. And I was unable to separate that by the trench method. So I gave it to you mixed up in that bag. And the last bag will be pebbles from the bottom layer.
Okay, Al, and about what's the thickness of the intermediate layer there?
This is the trenching sample.
Well, it's really ephemeral. It's almost, it's very thin. I would say no more than a quarter of an inch thick, and I just noticed it because of the difference in the grain structure as I was digging the trench.
Roger.
Now, Shepard has taken a scoop or a shovel device and tried to scoop a trench.
Bag 220.
I think that was the number.
So, the sample, the
that's the sample number, I think.
Also mixed up with the some of the surface materials falling down in on top of it. And that's about, call it 18 inches below the surface.
About a foot and a half, 18 inches below the surface. That's a pretty good trench.
Evidently, the walls of the trench don't support much of an angle at all, and they tend to fall back into the trench that he's dug.
So while Mitchell stopping short on his triple core tube.
This is Al at 3.75, and reading...
That's his seat pressure.
About, reading 3.5, I have no flags. And I'm in medium flow, now going to mid flow, and feeling good.
3.5 is 35% remaining. He said 3.75, and I have 3.5. I think he didn't say percent. They usually.
I think that's percentage.
Does that mean remaining or you?
Remaining.
When you read your flag there.
Yeah, I think that's what he's reading is remaining.
That's a good percentage at this stage of the EVA.
Well, I think they have. More than adequate to complete what they've planned.
Mm-hmm. No flags means?
No warning flags on the indicator panel in front of them.
It means all the parameters of the life support system are okay.
Right.
The slight leak, which was reported in Ed Mitchell's suit on the EVA yesterday, was reported to be of no consequence, we have learned. Also, we have also learned that the University of Texas has ranged on the laser at this point.
Yes, I heard that. I heard that last night.
We've done a good sighting.
And we need a pan.
We want another panoramic view of this area. That's Fred Hayes in Mission Control.
Oh, good.
Mitchell apparently had a rock and lost it.
I got
a picture. So Shepard is reporting that the walls kept falling down on the side of his trench as he dug it down some 18 inches, foot and a half, and he's a little concerned about whether he has given a stratified sample or whether he got material from the very bottom, the deepest portion of this.
I can just visualize what his problems are and the frustrations he's going through as he's trying to reach the bottom of that trench and the walls keep falling in.
Did you and Neil get anything below the actual surface, or is it mostly just surface material, dust and rock?
Well, we attempted to scrape away the top layer and then take a sample of what was underneath that.
Mm-hmm. I was going to try something else here, I believe. They've been very busy, and they've been watching the timeline very carefully. They made up 30 minutes by bypassing two of the stops on the way down from...
We have about 8 minutes left here at Triplet.
Triplet is station G.
That's the current mail. That's included in this time. And when you start out, we'd like you to make some grab samples as you pass by North Triplet.
That's a new phrase. I didn't hear that one during Apollo 11, some grab samples.
Well, that means you grab what you can as you're going.
It's explicit.
Without going through the complete documentation, photographic sequence.
Mm-hmm. The second core didn't have anything in it. As soon as I opened it up, a little bit fell out, and the second core tube is empty.
Roger, Ed.
That means in his course...
Evidently, the material is compacting in the lower core tube and is not going up, and I'm sure that that's one of the reasons that he's having problems driving it down. It's just like he's trying to drive a cylinder with a flat end to it when it compacts up inside that core tube.
Yesterday, we noticed as they were moving around the touchdown spot, you commented on this, Buzz, that there was the very fine dust on the top and apparently a fairly solid
layer down underneath,
about an inch or two below. Inch or two below. Missed that. Something about something in a pocket.
He's reaching in his pocket.
Now, they have accomplished quite a number of things during this excursion. We heard Ed Mitchell working the magnetometer at several places. Documented sample coming up. They are going through the little routine of carefully photographing an area all around... a rock sample before they put it in a bag. Number the bag very carefully and stow it. That's a grab sample of one of those interesting white rocks.
Yes, I think these are the ones that they think may be of the original lunar crust material.
And it's going up to 25.
Into the trench again in an effort to acquire a sample from the bottom. We're at 135 hours, 22 minutes ground elapsed time, 3 hours, 33 minutes since time of cabin depressurization. Our countdown clock shows 56 minutes remaining on this second lunar excursion.
They were given a 30-minute extension.
Right. Yes, but I heard that they'd cut that back by 15 minutes.
I missed that. That means it won't be quite 4 hours, 45 minutes.
No, about 4.5 hours, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Speaking, there is a special request, Robin, grab samples at the north crater rim there. They'd like to get a documented sample of a partially buried rock.
Okay.
Buzz, now, would you describe for our listeners the tools and the materials they're using at this point? The same hand tools you use in doing your sampling around the surface of the moon on Apollo 11, the types of things?
Well, yeah. They've got a scoop and tongs and an extension handle that can be screwed into the end of these, and then there's a hammer that's used to drive the core tubes into the ground.
Mm-hmm. These are carried on an equipment carrier, and then this is hung on the
This is put on
met.
The met, right.
And we mentioned, I think they have a little larger shovel or scoop this time, which Al has
used. For the trenching, yes.
For the trenching.
Been using that.
Mm-hmm. Now, isn't there a little bag dispenser for these rocks that have the number?
Yes, it's much like a small little drinking cup dispenser, and they're all one inside the other, and they have a little flag on the outside, which is the numbering system that's used for documenting each bag, so that there's a little metal tag on them with this number stamped on it. So they read this out, and it's recorded by voice, and they use that to match with the filming so that the scientists back here can have pictures of the sample, and in addition have confirmation by the numbering system and the voice recordings, and put all this together and make sure that the sample that's being examined is the one that was photographed.
That voice labeling is very important, isn't it? That's used as one of the primary means of recording when he says bag E or bag D or something like that.
Well, that helps to tie it all together. Of course, the photographs that are taken of the sample in just about every case enable the geologist to identify the particular rock.
And which pictures to match it with.
Right.
Uh-huh. Well, now, how does this panoramic view of the area, this extensive photography, assist in giving that rock perspective, its history?
Seal protector.
Well,
came
what they do is take stereo pictures instead of a panorama. The panorama that they've been talking about is to get the larger view of the area that they're working in. And out of this panorama, very frequently they're able to identify some of the samples that later will be documented.
Have you heard anything anywhere as to what this white-looking rock might be?
Well, I think that there was a rock similar to this that was brought back from Apollo 12, and they were hoping that they would find a large number of these type rocks in this area, because they feel that this could very well be the original surface or the original crust of the lunar surface,
mm-hmm.
instead of the filled-in Mare areas that were the sites for Apollo 11 and Apollo 12.
Mm-hmm.
This site here is up in the highlands and what may have been the original crust material.
Mm-hmm. Also, around this crater, particularly Cone Crater, we might have some deep ejecta as part
right.
of the crust.
Right, it's going down and obviously hit the original crust material and thrown out many of the pieces.
You might call it bedrock.
Right,
samples
bedrock.
Of bedrock.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to move out now.
Shepard had the problem on the seal on one of his containers just a moment ago.
In fact, 26
up.
Okay. They're being urged to move on now by Fred Hayes. You're listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of Apollo 14. Apollo 11 astronaut Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon, is assisting us in describing Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell's activities at the Fraumaro Highlands site. Is that a core tube he's working with again this time?
He seems to be having difficulty with some of his equipment. I'm not sure what it is.
Mm-hmm.
We have to remember that they're working with these bulky suits and gloves that are not too convenient to pick up things, and I think they're doing an admirable job.
That's one of the very major things is the impediment you have against
right.
your own mobility.
Roger.
He got it, I think. He's trying to get a.
Okay, everything's on so far.
They're going toward the limb now. This is right along the timeline, then, traversing back toward the limb. About 3 hours and 40 minutes into this excursion. They spent quite a bit of time around this triplet crater area, one of the major landmarks which Shepard used in the descent and touchdown.
Okay, we're close to
the... Shepard.
Here's the triplet right up ahead of us. Gentry, we're going to have to go a little bit to the north to around it, I think. Is this a triplet? Yep. We're approaching triplet from the east.
They've been all around it then. They've been rambling in a greater area than I had realized.
A little rock field down here, small boulder field. I'll get a document sample from. Okay.
Some of these rocks must be fairly well embedded.
I'm sure they are.
And, we've heard some difficulty in getting them loose.
The shiny cam. Damn it, you see, huh? Hey, the shiny cam is retrieved. Press on.
The shiny something is retrieved.
That's a mush head right down the middle and get a document sample there. Okay.
That's something they left on the way... No, they didn't go by this.
No. Tall rock, beautiful, right there, right to your left. Oh, it's just the right size.
They had some trouble going into the sun, seeing some of these things, I noticed, and they expected to be able to see these rocks, some of these interesting things, much better when they had the sun
to
their back.
Yes, you have a much better view when you're looking with the sun to your back.
Okay.
So there's been an immense temptation to... spend more time on interesting rocks during the traverse back, and they did make much faster time coming back down off Cone Crater. It took them about 20 to 30 minutes to climb that rise to the rim during the first part of this excursion.
Get the locator. Yep. I see the camera things.
They're still... couple of hundred meters to the east of the lunar module.
Okay, now as soon as you wrap this one up, we're going to have to press on back to the limb, or we're going to be really tight on the closeout.
Shepard Mitchell now working at the rim of North Crater.
They haven't said whether they can see the limb at this point, have they?
I think they're within sight of it, coming down the terrain that... Well,
it looks like they should be able to see it.
They should be able to see it.
Yeah. A
couple of hundred meters away.
Well,
600 feet.
Another, okay.
Another interesting rock.
Surprising. I've heard Ed say so many times it's so much further than I thought, so much different from what I thought. I think they've done an amazing job of anticipating and training for this entire flight.
You're touching on something that's extremely interesting there, and that is the difficulty in estimating distances without familiar references.
That's right.
You know the size of the limb if you see it there, so you can tell about how far it is from you. How do you compensate for that, Buzz,
well,
when you're walking around?
Even known objects, when it's in such a foreign environment, I know that Pete and Al had a good bit of difficulty estimating their distance when they were maybe 400 or 600 feet. It always looked like they were much further away than they actually were. They, from the surface, and they looked back at the limb, and they put some things out and deployed them. The limb looked very small, so they estimated it to be a greater distance. And then when they got back in the limb and looked down at where they had deployed this, well, it looked like it was very close to them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very deceiving, depending on what your frame of reference is.
Do you just compensate through experience or trial and error once you're there?
I think we'll have to gain experience in range estimation.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be difficult.
They're being instructed. They stopped on the north rim. They are now heading on back, being instructed to head on back. You're listening to the Voice of America's coverage of the flight of Apollo 14, live from Houston and from the moon. You're hearing the live voices of Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell as they are making these comments as they move about on the surface of the moon at this very moment. With us is astronaut Buzz Aldrin, a man who's been there on Apollo 11, helping us describe for you this event. This is Al Shepard.
Shepard Mitchell heading back now to the vicinity of the lunar module, Antares.
Buzz, would you like to go into some of the implications of how this material is enabling scientists to learn more about the moon's formation and about how it really is? It's amazing to me how it's beginning to help us learn more about how the Earth itself came to be.
Well, I just heard the other day that some of the geologists were changing completely their theory and fractionalization processes of minerals that are formed when rocks, when molten rock solidifies because of many of the discoveries that they've found on the moon. So it seems strange that we're relearning how to understand the Earth because of our better understanding of what's formed the moon. And, of course, that's one of the major purposes in our going there, to investigate the processes that may have been taking place in the formation of our solar system. And I think that's the implication of what we're...
This is something that will take years for full public awareness, and also the scientists will be working for years with the data they receive. Just one short excursion of 3 or 4 hours give scientists enough to work for over a year on in-depth analysis.
I'm sure they'll be working for 10, 20 years before they can completely analyze all of this information.
Al Shepard reports they're moving toward the limb now.
Okay, that's
finally.
You can do it the way you want to. Guess you do it without the limb.
Without the mat, yeah.
Without the mat, because there's no way to... anything falls off, we've lost all those goodies.
They've been outside about 3 hours and 50 minutes now. They dropped just a bit behind again, picking up some interesting rocks.
I noticed Fred's encouraging them to keep moving, head back toward the LEM. I guess he's getting a little concerned about the consumables that they have in their backpack.
One of the things which...
Okay, and I got a chance for you on the air, my
friend. All right, let me give you a call when I get there and when I'm aligned and level.
He is to go back to the ALSEP experiments package and realign the transmitting antenna. The signal's a bit weak. I think that's what they were talking about there. That's something that they... didn't do at the beginning of EVA in order to get off onto the excursion to Cone Crater. And Al Shepard is now traversing from this triplet complex back toward the LEM. And they did indeed spend a considerable amount of time around this interesting complex of three.
I'm out in the area of the boulder field. I'm going to photograph many of the boulders.
That's Mitchell.
The rocks, the broken ones, the big ones, what have you. And then grab as many of the different fragments as I can around these piles of broken boulders. Now that I'm here, I see a large number of inclusions. I can't tell whether they're crystals or not. I think that they are. And I'll grab as many of these and give you before and after shots as I can of a whole way back full of rocks.
Okay, Ed, that sounds great.
That very lucid report from Ed Mitchell as he is photographing rocks and boulders in a great boulder field as he moves back toward the lunar module. This is Rhett Turner in Houston with astronaut Buzz Aldrin. We'll be reporting more to you from Mission Control in just a few moments.
You are listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the flight of Apollo 14. We'll continue, but first, here is a summary of news.
President Nixon watched the first moonwalk on television, then sent his congratulations to the three astronauts and the ground workers in Houston for making the landing a success. The president said, in a message to Mission Control, that the landing was a thrilling event for mankind. He also wished the astronauts a safe and successful return to Earth and invited them and their wives to a White House dinner and to spend a weekend at his Camp David retreat in nearby Maryland. In Bonn, the West German deputies broke into applause in the Bundestag when the president interrupted a debate to announce that the Apollo had landed on the moon. Many East European and Soviet radio stations reported the Apollo flight, and millions of Yugoslavs heard a live Apollo broadcast via the Houston Space Station over Belgrade radio. Hungarian scientist Péter Hédervári, head of the International Lunar Society, said that Hungarians were very proud that envoys of mankind are on the moon again. Dr. Hédervári said this Apollo mission is especially important scientifically, not only because the moon mission was expanded, but because the spacecraft landed on one of the oldest parts of the moon. The Antares is scheduled to blast off from the moon at 18 hours 47 Greenwich Mean Time and will redock with the command module Kitty Hawk a short while later. After the docking, astronauts Alan Shepard and Edgar Mitchell will leave the Antares and return to the command module. A short time later, the Antares will be disconnected from the Kitty Hawk and will crash on the moon as planned. The crew will fire the command module's big engine at 1 hour 38 Greenwich Mean Time Sunday to pull them out of moon orbit and then send them on the almost three-day trip back to Earth. Splashdown and recovery is scheduled in the Pacific Ocean Tuesday afternoon. The Soviet Union says its moon robot, Lunokhod, will begin its fourth exploration of lunar space later today, one day ahead of schedule. The eight-wheeled robot has been in a period of hibernation during the long lunar night, awaiting the return of sunshine to restore power to its solar batteries. Lunokhod landed on the moon in the Luna 17 spacecraft last November. The Soviet robot is operating in the Sea of Rains area, several hundred kilometers north of Frau Mauro Highlands, where America's Apollo 14 astronauts are exploring the moon's surface in person. A South Vietnamese-Cambodian drive against communist strongholds northeast of Phnom Penh has succeeded in retaking several areas occupied by North Vietnamese troops since last June. The drive, which began on Wednesday, includes four Cambodian battalions and about 10,000 South Vietnamese troops. In South Vietnam, fog and rain slowed the massive Allied operation in Quang Tri province near the border of southern Laos. The offensive there began 8 days ago, when 29,000 South Vietnamese and American troops moved into the border area behind an extensive air attack. Meanwhile, a military spokesman in the Lao administrative capital of Vientiane says North Vietnamese communist troops Friday overran the government outpost at Mung Pot, west of the Plain of Jars. The United States and South Korea have agreed to the withdrawal of 20,000 American troops and a new program to modernize the South Korean armed forces. The troop pullback is part of President Nixon's plan to encourage Asian nations to participate more widely in their own defense. The joint announcement in Seoul said the American troop reduction in South Korea will not affect the determination of the United States to meet its obligations under the 1954 Mutual Defense Treaty. The United States is reported willing to discuss a possible Big Four guarantee of a Middle East settlement that may be reached between Israel and the Arabs. VOA diplomatic correspondent Walter Cole says the United States would require that both sides seriously pursue the current peace talks without imposing deadlines on each other. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Golda Meir criticized Egyptian President Anwar Sadat were urging a partial withdrawal of Israeli forces from occupied areas of the Suez Canal without saying if Egypt would sign a peace agreement with Israel. The Israeli cabinet meets Sunday to discuss President Sadat's proposals, and United Nations Secretary General U Thant welcomed the Middle East ceasefire extension for another 30 days. Jordan's King Hussein appealed for national unity and the preservation of peace. In a nationwide broadcast on the eve of the Muslim feast of Al-Adha, the king said that Palestinians must work together as one force. He also said those seeking to divide Jordan do not deserve to live in the country, and he urged all Arab nations to forget their differences for the good of the Arab cause. The Indian government named a committee to investigate the hijacking of an Indian airliner to Pakistan. The government also asked Pakistan to return immediately the two members of the Kashmir Liberation Front who hijacked the plane and destroyed it in Lahore, West Pakistan. In New Delhi, police fought students trying to attack the Pakistan High Commission for the fourth day in protest against the plane's destruction. More than 300 policemen and 23 students were injured on the third day. In Pakistan, students demonstrated outside the Indian High Commission in Islamabad. There were no reports of injury. At least four persons, including a British soldier, were killed in Belfast, Northern Ireland, as troops fought rioters for the third straight night. 12 persons were injured, and nearly 40 were arrested. The soldier and one civilian were killed in a gun battle that began when machine gun fire raked an army foot patrol. In a second battle in the same Roman Catholic area of the city, another civilian was shot dead by British troops when they came under sniper fire. During the exchange of gunfire, still another civilian blew himself up when a bomb he was about to throw exploded. Troop reinforcements were rushed into Belfast. The violence spread for the first time in some months to Londonderry, where a police station and a post office were attacked. Violence erupted in at least 7 major Italian cities after a 2-hour general strike to protest a hand grenade attack Thursday on a left-wing demonstration in Catanzaro. In Rome, police used tear gas to repulse leftist students who attacked them with firebombs. And rightists and leftists fought in Genoa, Milan, Bologna, Turin, Messina, and Naples. The 8th plenary session of the Polish Communist Party's Central Committee has opened in Warsaw. PAP, the official Polish news agency, said the session will evaluate the December rioting over food price increases and current party tasks. Today's meeting is the first Central Committee session since Edvard Gierek replaced former party chief Władysław Gomułka, who resigned on December 20th. Canada's Minister of Manpower and Immigration, Otto Lang, says the Soviet Union will buy $25 million worth of flour from his country for shipment to Cuba. Mr. Lang said the Soviet flour purchase will be equivalent to 12,300,000 bushels of wheat. It will be shipped from Canada's eastern ports sometime this year. The Soviet Union has been spending $1,300,000 per day to help support the Cuban economy, which long has suffered from serious shortages of food and other goods. That's the news on the Voice of America, Leo Scully reporting.
You're listening to the Voice of America's worldwide coverage of the flight of Apollo 14, now 135 hours, 47 minutes into the mission. The astronauts are now in the final phase of their second moon walk. We take you back to Rhett Turner and Colonel Edwin Aldrin at the Manned Spacecraft Center in Houston.
We're watching the astronauts as they've moved back to the area of the lunar module. Buzz Aldrin and I can now see them on our color television camera. They've moved back into view of the camera, turned the camera toward the lunar module, and they're beginning the closeout procedure for this EVA. Buzz, this has gone beautifully then in with this tight timeline.
It certainly has. It's amazing to me the way that they've been able to accomplish so many of the tasks that they set out to do. I know they feel quite oh, maybe not discouraged, that they were unable to get all the way to the top of Cone Crater.
Each of these timelines, going back to the other successful landings now, in Apollo 11, your flight with Neil Armstrong, and Conrad and Bean's Apollo 12, this pressure to press on, is, to use your phrase, is there in all of these missions, isn't it, in maintaining these timelines and safety margins?
Yes, well, it's very helpful to have the people on the ground keeping track of the timeline as it goes along and keeping you on schedule, because it's very easy to get absorbed or wrapped up into each one of these endeavors that they're accomplishing.
So we shouldn't misinterpret this conversation from the capsule communicator telling him to move on, keep moving. This is really his backup.
That's right. He's like a scheduler for them, and, mm-hmm. and sort of adds to their checklist and keeps them on a timeline.
Let's hear Al.
I can do this with two hands, but I've got to try a little sand trap shot here.
Sounds like he's ready to... Yeah, he's swinging the golf club.
He's trying to see how far a rock will go when you hit it.
They got more dirt than ball inside.
Look at the dust go up in the air.
Here we go again. That looked like a slice to me, Al. There we go. Ready to die. One more.
I presume these are rocks he's hitting.
Ah, I could see that one go.
Yeah.
It must have gone about...
Miles and miles.
At least 5 meters.
At least 5 meters.
Very good, Al. And answer Ed's question earlier there. Kilo Kilo was used for the window shot, Ed, so you ought to bring it back.
I hope they got some film of that somehow to give us an idea of how missiles travel there, how... A projectile, a rock, sails off in this 1/6 gravity.
We could see the rock moving.
Mm-hmm. It did have an arc to it. It didn't just go straight off forever at all, did it? Both of the astronauts are in front of the main part of the limb, in front of the equipment stowage area.
Yes, what they're doing is... getting all the documented samples and putting them into the equipment transfer bag that they'll then transfer up in the clothesline assembly up into the interior of the LEM.
The first lunar golfer.
Okay, Ed Houston. One additional item on the return is to bring back the 100-foot tether. That should also go on ETP.
Do they... They don't seal the rock boxes up outside?
Oh, yes. Yes, they seal them up outside.
The SRCs, the sample return containers, these are the vacuum sealed containers.
Right, they'll put the documented samples in.
You're talking about the bag, but then the box goes in the transfer bag.
The box goes in the transfer bag,
and up the clothesline. The conveyor belt. Now, the astronauts are beginning their closeout procedure, and they're back pretty close to the original timeline. Oh, no, I stand corrected. They're past 4 hours. They've been outside about 4 hours and 5 minutes so far.
Well, they've extended about 15, perhaps 20 minutes, so mm-hmm. so they're about on schedule, I think, approaching the point of transferring the equipment.
You told me that I heard that they had the 30-minute extension, and you reported to me that they had backed off 15 minutes. Do
yes,
you
I think this,
why?
Well, as I gathered it, it was due to the further evaluation of the consumables that were left in one of the backpacks.
Mm-hmm.
So the extension was dependent upon how much quantity they the ground estimated was available to them.
With a very good safety margin, that's... certainly taken into account, so that the fellows have plenty of air left by the time they don't need it anymore in those backpacks. Now, this will take some minutes to pack up. You describe what they're doing and why it takes so much time, Buzz, to pack up this stuff, all these...
Well, they're assembling all the samples and putting them into the rock boxes, and you have to very carefully pack them so that... all the material isn't jostled around during the accelerations that rock boxes will be experiencing during reentry.
Do you put some foam or
pads and things around them
to keep them from rattling?
Some filler material that is packed in around all of the samples.
And we have four core tubes.
Al Shepard reporting on what he has.
We're at 135 hours, 53 minutes ground elapsed time, and at 4 hours, 5 minutes since time of cabin depressurization.
One of the men is out by the, rolling up the window shade device, the ion detector. Solar wind.
Solar wind, yes. They'll put that in a container, and they'll take that back up into the LEM, too.
Now this solar wind device, what looks like a silver window shade, has been there picking up particles coming from the sun since the landing, since shortly after the first explosion.
Yes, it was one of the first things that was deployed during the first EVA, if you remember. They want to maximize the exposure that that this has to the solar wind. Incidentally, this is an example of some of the cooperation that we've been receiving from experimenters around the world. The principal investigator for this is from Switzerland.
Dr. Johannes Geis from Bern. And he has been quite happy with his results from your initial experiment brought back from Apollo 11, the Apollo 12 landing, and this one. Speaking of the science, let's discuss that some more, Buzz. Are you aware of any of the further findings? It's been a year and a half since your landing on the moon, Apollo 11. The scientists are still working on that material and still discovering things from just your samples, aren't they?
Yes. Well, of course, they have further samples from Apollo 12 to compare them with, and each time that we bring back additional samples from these flights, we'll be going back and comparing them in detail with the areas that were looked at in the previous missions to get a better picture of the total spread and distribution of these samples, to piece together the puzzle, to try and get a better understanding into the formations and the processes that have taken place on the moon.
And we mentioned just a few minutes earlier that for years, the scientists will be learning more from the moon and helping us evaluate and deduce the origins of the Earth itself, erosion processes, the processes which have caused the Earth to develop into the wonderful little oasis on which we live, can be analyzed from this cold, well-documented orb that's going around our Earth. And I'm amazed at just what they've learned so far in this year and a half in analyzing material and in comparing.
Well, of course, they've learned more in a year and a half than man has ever dreamed of learning in the centuries that we've been here.
We have learned more in a year and a half since bringing material from the moon than in all of man's history about the real origins of our planet and our solar system. That is a real scientific phenomenon, and we must be aware of the fact that we are really witnessing one of humankind's greatest moments in this series of flights. We all certainly hope that they will be extended, and we may go on when priorities permit in the future. Buzz, thank you very much for being with us. I understand you have to leave to go for another... you're going to be on television here, and maybe some of our viewers overseas may be seeing you there as this signal, this television signal, this color camera signal from the moon is going around the world, and possibly one of our media will have you there as a guest for some of the same listeners who've been with us for this radio broadcast. Thank you very, very
Fine.
Much.
Well, Rhett, I certainly have enjoyed being here with you.
Okay, we'll be seeing you and talking with you more, too. Colonel Buzz Aldrin, the second man on the moon from Apollo 11.
Thank you.
Shepard and Mitchell are now still working on those rock boxes. As Buzz outlined to you, it takes considerable amount of time for each of those rocks to be stowed. Let's listen. This is the Voice of America broadcasting worldwide the activities of Al Shepard and Ed Mitchell on the surface of the moon. You're hearing the live broadcast voices of the two astronauts as they talk, as they move about on the surface right now.
Okay.
They've completed over 4 hours, about 4 hours and 10 minutes, during this geological excursion of the surface, doing sampling as outlined, as very carefully planned by the best geologists, the best scientists on Earth, and to the best of their ability. It's been a hectic timeline. It's taking them a bit longer on some parts of this mission, particularly climbing up the fairly steep hill up to the edge of what has been called Cone Crater, and we'll tell you more about that. Let's listen to the activities of Shepard and Mitchell. They're really sort of mumbling to each other here now, rather than to mission control.
No, I won't go. All right, we need to put the 27 bag, right? Yeah.
They're deciding between themselves. They're deciding how they're to stow the bags containing all of the small rock samples. In the staff support room in Mission Control, the scientists certainly must be jubilant over the sound they've been hearing, the reports they've been getting from Shepard and Mitchell on some of the unusual new rocks they have found, as we've been reporting to you, particularly this white type of rock formation.
Foot tether being brought back, this to tie down some gear. The present plan is to bring back the probe. We're at 135 hours, correction, 136 hours ground elapsed time. And we show 4 hours, 11 minutes since the time of depressurization.
4 hours, 11 minutes. They still can stay out about another 20 minutes.
Hold it up. Okay. You got everything else? Put all the others in here? Yeah, we need one more check here. See if we can get some more in this bag.
See if we can get some more in this bag, says Al Shepard. He's talking about the conveyor bags now, not the rock boxes. There was a little confusion there in my mind a moment ago, and Buzz Aldrin straightened me out on that. They're talking about getting some more samples in this bag. Of course, they're sealing them in these vacuum-sealed rock boxes, SRC, sample return containers, and then the conveyor belt, which they use to lift this material up into the lunar module itself, has some bags attached, and they're trying to efficiently pack the bags so they can get them up across the ladder and into the hatch. The long tether, the 100-foot tether, some 30 meters long, is to be saved in order to be used to help tie down a portion of this probe and drogue docking assembly. They're apparently going to remove the probe in the command module after docking.
See if it is. Oh, Lefty himself. Outstanding.
Oh. Shepard just...
Right in the middle of the crater. Stabilized. Wasn't bad at all. Beautiful.
He just threw the... Shepard was commenting, and I believe Ed Mitchell threw one of the staff support poles, probably the one holding the...
Ed, I didn't hear the solar wind called off there. Did you get that one, sir?
The solar wind support pole. He threw it just like a javelin, and it sailed way off into the distance. And Shepard said, outstanding, as he watched it go.
It's in the ETB now.
ETB, equipment transfer bag.
Okay,
we'll just have these three way bags there.
Okay, did the 100-foot tether also get into the ETB?
That's permanent,
good
there.
That javelin-looking throwaway item was possibly the solar wind pole.
That's,
Okay, we'll take,
You heard that speculation there, agrees with ours.
Yeah.
One of the astronauts, I believe, stumbled on the television cable just a moment ago. There's not a third man up there. We can see both of them in the TV picture. And all of a sudden, the camera moved.
I just wanted to check once again on the camera mags to make sure you got four 70s and four 16-millimeter mags. I guess one of the 70s is on the camera.
That's Fred Hayes asking for a confirmation on the many things which are to be returned. I want to leave something on the moon by accident that should be brought back. Some of the pictures, for instance. A check from Hayes also on the solar wind window shade.
Let's press on.
That's Shepard saying, let's press on.
You want to...
That's a well-known astronaut term there. I think we better keep an eye on them if they're going to pull off some more of these light gravity. I almost call them experiments. They're a little more jocular than that, lighthearted, but certainly some of the things, some of the material which isn't to be taken back, you could call it junk. The great temptation to throw some javelins and to act as a golfer and hit some rocks. Shepard's done that. And they're very interesting to see in the 1/6 gravity.
Did you, I saw you over here. Did you get a picture?
I did.
With the limb in the foreground?
Yep.
Yep. Several.
Mitchell asking Shepard if he got a picture.
Okay, you ready to go up? Sure.
All right, Fred, I'm starting up the ladder.
Okay, here goes Mitchell up the ladder.
Going up the ladder now.
Oh, the camera fell over. The camera fell over. I think I was right. Shepard indeed stumbled on the TV cable. I guess he's going to go over and set it up again. That cable is in the dust there, and they're moving right around the area of its deployment. That's Shepard coming over to put the television camera back up on its tripod. He tripped on the cable. It did fall over. See some sun's glare there in it.
Shepard uprighting the television camera, which was knocked over.
Okay, Fred, you're going to have a real practical problem here. Paul will be able to see what the lunar dust does to a camera lens.
Al says you're going to have a practical problem here. To see what the...
Do you see anything at all?
Yeah, I think it's a better picture. Lunar dust helps the TV picture, I guess.
Discussion of what the lunar dust does.
TV lens will get dusted in the future. Yep. Cut you down four stops, Fred.
Yeah, that's just about centered there.
And there's Ed Mitchell back on the ladder, going up the ladder of the limb.
Okay, Ed, you can start up now. I'm already halfway up. Good show.
Shepard's trying to...
Mitchell's heart rate, go up the ladder, 114.
We can see Shepard tossing the cable around, trying to get it out of the way of his area of movement.